day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Greater New York Hospital Association conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require further assistance, please press star, then zero, your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. Now I'd like to turn it over to your host, Ms. Rachel Block from the United Hospital Fund. Ms. Block, you may begin.
Thank you very much, and thank you, everybody, for joining us. We probably still have a few people who are signing on, but we wanted to make sure we were starting relatively promptly. And Terry Straub and Hillary Jalon are also with us here today. We have a great speaker who you've heard from before, but we're really excited that Karen Scott Collins from the Health and Hospitals Corporation could join us again today. I just wanted to give you a tiny bit of context and background for why we asked Karen to come back today and lead into some of our future discussions in terms of summarizing our experience from the first year of our own collaborative activity. First off, we had the opportunity to participate in the last learning session for the Health and Hospitals Corporation's Critical Care Unit Directors Network, and at that point they were reviewing their accomplishments for their first year of activity for their collaborative. So we thought it would be helpful, since we are thinking about how we would like to summarize our experience, to hear a little bit from Karen about what some of their, again, update on some of the results that they're looking at this point. And also some insights into what they see as some of the key challenges and opportunities going forward in terms of both sustaining and building on the improvement activities and obviously the considerable investments that everyone across HHC has made in the success of these interventions. In addition, though, Karen's presentation will tie in a little bit to the second agenda item, which Hillary is going to take the lead on, because, as you know, while we initially started our have put our emphasis for this collaborative collecting outcome measures of actual infection rates, we have had a continuing interest in trying to gather information on the process measures, and particularly various components of bundle implementation, use of checklists, and other key parts of the overall package of interventions. And so Karen's presentation will include some reference to some of the data that HHC has been collecting from the beginning on that, but then it'll be a nice segue into Hillary's report back to you on the preliminary results of the survey, which many of you at this point have responded to in terms of the process side of the CLAB's collaborative activity. So that was just a quick way of saying that we're very excited to have Karen with us. So we think that all along we tried to monitor HHC's progress on the same kinds of issues that we've been working on with this collaborative. One final note is that at our last board meeting of the United Hospital Fund, which was just last week, our board approved two grants, an additional grant to the Health and Hospitals Corporation to continue with some of the work around sustaining their critical care improvement activities, and then an additional grant for the Greater New York Hospital Association and the United Hospital Fund to continue working together on sustaining and building on the CLAB's experience. So while we are at this point going to discuss with you all of our plans for the future, this is a way to sort of set the stage for thinking about what we've accomplished so far and hearing a little bit from Karen on her observations of where HHC is thinking about going. And so with that, I'd like to turn it over to Karen.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Rachel and Terry and Hillary, for inviting me to be back on the call this afternoon. I'm really happy to talk a little bit about what we've done and what we've learned. I feel like we still have a lot more to learn, so I look forward to the rest of the discussion as well. Just as a quick reminder on where we started, about actually about 2 years ago, we started bringing the ICU clinical leadership, the directors from the units across our 11 hospitals, together to meet each other and to begin to have some discussions related to areas for potential improvement and in critical care services, and also areas for potential where we really could leverage kind of the fact that, you know, leverage working together rather than working as 11 separate institutions. And one of the major activities to come out of bringing the ICU directors together has been a much higher profile and level of activity around improvement, performance improvement in critical care. And so for us, our initial focus has been on how we incorporate and implement a set of evidence-based practices to improve outcomes in critical care. And the biggest areas of focus so far have been on implementation of the ventilator bundle and the central line bundle, along with improving strengthening team communication, in the units, and particularly using the tools of multidisciplinary rounds and the daily goal sheets as a way to focus on the communication aspects. And as you'll see, they really tie together the more that you do work in these areas. Also, certainly what's happened over the course of the year is that we've worked on these and we keep adding more areas that are identified and of interest to the ICU leadership. Moving to the just if you have the slides in front of you, I'm just moving to the third slide in the set. The areas that we really focused on in terms of our long-term objectives for improving critical care outcomes include looking at a reduction in ventilator days, a reduction in the ICU length of stay, mortality, and declines in the rates of infections through ventilator associated pneumonia and catheter-related bloodstream infections. We had, across the 11 hospitals, we gave people an option of where they started this work, so we have a mix of the kind of initial critical care unit in each facility. In some cases is the medical ICU, in some cases it's the surgical ICU. In some of our hospitals, there actually are combined units. So we have a bit of a mix in kind of where people started from, and also as you might imagine, a bit of a mix in terms of what people started with. So we had some hospitals, and I know you've heard from Queens, that were really started with a focus on continuing to work on reducing their central line infection rates, and similarly other hospitals where the initial focus, which built on work they were doing, was related to the ventilator outcomes. But over the period of the year, that's now starting to even out, so that hospitals that started with a focus in some of these areas or some of these measures are now adding on the others. So we're also learning that this takes some time and some patience and some persistence, but we are starting to see some positive progress from it. So on the next slide, to give you a bit of sense of, in terms of our first areas of outcomes are really related to the process measures. We asked the teams to report monthly on the ventilator bundle and central line bundle compliance, as well as on their outcomes data. And what we've seen over the past few months is that for the five hospitals focusing on ventilator bundle compliance, and again, we only count the compliance if they, if every part of the bundle has been applied to that patient on a ventilator. We've seen excellent progress in some of the hospitals in these, in the five who have been reporting regularly over the past few months. Their compliance with the ventilator bundle has gone from about 60% up to over 95% or better. Similarly, with the central line bundle compliance, again, only counting those patients where all components of the bundle are complied with, we have gone from about 45%, average of 45% across five of our hospitals to, again, but 95% or better. This really gives us a significant amount of opportunity to learn from what from their experience and from what they have implemented to be able to reach and sustain, and I should say in most of these cases for the bundle compliance, the focus and improvement really happened over the first 3 or 4 months of focus of the improvement collaborative last year. And the really nice thing is that we, you know, they've continued to measure it so that we know that they've really been able to sustain the bundle over now a 6 or 7 month period. Similarly, we, in their written part of their reports, we get updates from them on the communication aspects. There's much more use of some version of daily goal sheets to facilitate communication across the unit. That's a much more regular occurrence than it was a year ago. And more use of multidisciplinary rounds, although clearly a lot of challenges around having the staff available to make that feasible as often as we would, you know, ideally like to see it happen. And then we're beginning to see some promising results in terms of the outcomes, with some declining infection rates. A couple of the hospitals going 2 or more months without any central line infections, and again with the hospitals that have focused on ventilator-associated pneumonia. Decline compared to the prior year in their rates of ventilator-associated pneumonia. So we're continuing to watch that data very closely, but there do seem to be some improvement in those outcomes. On the next slide, just to note that in addition to kind of what our starting point focus in terms of ventilator and central line bundle and communication, there have been a number of other interventions or evidence-based practices that the hospitals and the clinical leadership in critical care have really identified as ones that they want to work on and approach in a more standardized manner across the corporation, or to really share what they their experience with interventions with the other hospitals. So a couple of the teams have really taken a lead on testing insulin protocol, implementing insulin protocols in their units, and improving glycemic control, weaning protocols. Also, we've had a couple of hospitals take the lead on those, and I think in both cases those have a lot of potential for us as a system to strengthen standardized care across the corporation. Another aspect of the central line work, particularly, is beginning to focus on how we extend that work beyond the unit, since clearly that's not the only place where central lines are being placed. Has created over time more of more communication and initial collaboration, particularly with our emergency department staff, so that we are beginning to again have a more standardized approach, in particularly to central line placement across the hospital. That also helps us in introducing the sepsis bundle, because the link between critical care and the emergency department staff is such a key component of being able to strengthen the interventions around severe sepsis. I actually heard from one of our hospitals yesterday, and it clearly was a sense of a significant leap forward and in terms of a culture change in the hospital, where they've really over the past few months in meeting with the emergency department staff gone from emergency room department fellows saying that, you know, they didn't need anyone to tell them how to put in a central line to everybody in the department following the central line bundle and everyone using the same insertion kit and procedures. So it's encouraging to get that sense that people really feel like there's a change in how receptive staff are in working with these interventions. And then in addition to these interventions, we've also added in a focus on end-of-life decision-making, and some hospitals have added on looking at the ways of increasing obtaining healthcare proxies and helping families with end-of-life decision-making. So it's been it's an extremely full set of interventions and agendas that we are trying to stay focused on over a long period of time. Again, on the slides, just moving to just a couple of observations on the slide 6. In terms of the central line infection rates, as I said, we're beginning to see some of the ICUs, some of the hospitals now at least have 2 to 3 months without an infection, without a central line infection in that unit. Several of the other hospitals are showing lower rates than the prior year. We've also tried to pay attention to when a run chart's been going in the right direction and then has a spike up in the other direction. And one of the interesting points at which that happened, and was nice to have several hospitals in the same room to share their data and look at that, was actually in the fall when we looked at the data from the late spring and summer in several of the hospitals who had been beginning to see have some lower rates. They then saw this spike up around June, July, which is in most cases, again, now started to come down. So it was a very much a shared experience, which took away some of the pain of people feeling like their data was starting to go in the opposite direction. But it also led to some really great ideas around using, identifying, developing training materials, certainly anticipating or linking some of that with changeovers in staff and how staff developing training videos, identifying all the points at which more education and in-service needed to be done, as well as helping people kind of anticipate the potential for the same sort of pattern in rates in the coming year. So some of the just moving to the the seventh slide, and just tried to summarize for us. Again, focusing on kind of the process of standardizing a practice or a set of practices has been quite helpful in helping to change the culture across the hospitals. And so for the central line bundle, there's a much more consistent sense of and buy-in to all the components of the bundle. The hospitals have incorporated the checklist for the central line bundle into their processes, into their timeout process, or into their daily goal sheets. So it has really become just a part of how they how they do the procedure. As I know all you have been doing or have done, we're also looking at identifying and creating at least one central line bundle insertion kit and maintenance kit for the corporation, and making those available as an option for every one of our hospitals, obviously rather than having each hospital do that themselves. But several of the hospitals have moved to having a kit and having everything in one place, and that certainly is increasing the obviously increases the compliance and facilitates following the bundle and the best insertion. There's been I think certainly all of this work has increased our focus on kind of on nursing's role in critical care services, and particularly in terms of in the improvement work, performance improvement work, and critical care and nursing leadership, particularly in implementing something like the central line checklist. But it's also clear that we kind of can't expect the nursing to take that leadership role if there's not an understanding across the entire clinical team of what the overall objectives are. So we kind of a lot of our hospitals say, we've worked to empower our nurses to stop the procedure, which is a key part of how they're making sure that there's compliance with the bundle. But the other part of that, is that they also make it very clear that it is acceptable and expected for the nurse to call the attending or a senior physician in the unit if the bundle's not being complied with. So I think having that communication across the team is really what is key to making it work as consistently as it's working in some of our hospitals. I think the bundle, again, also kind of focusing on the set of interventions is really helping to, disseminate the practice across the hospital. And so one of the things I'm pleased to see again, and to hear from the hospital critical care staff is that they are talking with the emergency department and they're talking with the OR, and some of the critical care nurses are meeting with the ED nurses to facilitate that training and information. And as I mentioned, some of the one of our hospitals, Queens, has particularly picked up on the increase in their rate last summer and used that as an opportunity to identify and develop some training materials, which they're now testing out. Underlying all of this, I think, is to be a really significant commitment to measuring the performance over a significant period of time, over many months. All of our hospitals this year will continue, we'll continue to ask for it for the, for their monthly measurements of how they're doing on compliance with the bundles as well as the outcomes measures. I guess that leads just leading into the final slide on sustaining improvement. Given that kind of being able to measure your performance and look at your performance over time is such a critical piece of sustaining the work, one of the things we'll be looking at this year is what we can kind of how we might be able to get some more help or support through our clinical information system for some of that data and feedback so that it can move from entirely being dependent on a separate sort of checklist or paper and pencil sort of process, which for us at the moment, it pretty much is. So as we think about sustaining the improvement, there are a couple of specific areas we're talking about, and we're really pleased to have continued support from United Hospital Fund to develop, in addition to continuing to support each of the hospitals and bring them together to share what they're doing and the performance and data that they're gathering. We think it's important to spend more focus on nursing's role in critical care improvement and on change and helping to change the practices in related to that in the hospitals. We'll be working on identifying what will be helpful to our nursing leadership and locally to support those roles. And part of that, I would say, will also be how we introduce more of the work that's being done around the country in terms of strengthening communication across the team, across a multidisciplinary team, such as using the SBAR tool. And thirdly, as I mentioned, we'll also be looking at how our clinical information systems can help sustain the improvement in a couple of ways. One is I put on here as decision support. Particularly, we're thinking of there where incorporating our ability to incorporate some of the protocols, such as the weaning protocol, into our electronic medical record and our electronic order system. Certainly supports and facilitates kind of the protocol being the easy thing to follow, rather than the special thing that you have to go and look up for a project. And then, as I said, also beginning to look at how we might be able to, how we can kind of pull some of the data on a regular basis from our electronic medical records to kind of have some regular feedback reports on performance in this area. And for us, we're doing this quite a bit now on the outpatient side in terms of our chronic disease management. So it's now time for us to turn to how we can do that in particular in the critical care area on the inpatient side. And certainly a continued focus on working with the senior leadership at this point, particularly so that they, to make sure they know what's been accomplished with the critical care teams, and to have their support as we identify other areas to work on that require bringing together different departments, as well as discussions about resources. So I think I'll stop there. Running out of time.
Erin, thank you so much. Operator, could we open it up now for questions or comments for a few minutes?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key. If your question has been answered and wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Once again, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key. Our first question comes from Robert Garcia from Brookdale Medical Center.
Oh, I am sorry, but I did not have a question.
Not a problem. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question, please press the 1 key. And we have a question from, forgive me if I pronounced this wrong, Manoj Karwa from
yes.
Montefiore Medical Center.
Yes. Hi, Karen. It's Manoj Karwa here
Hi.
At Montefiore. Very good presentation. We're actually doing a lot of the very similar work as
great.
Yourself.
Uh-huh.
I have a couple of questions. You on your slide, you mentioned ICU mortality.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, and length of stay, are you... is this risk adjusted? What are you using in terms of, are you using any kind of risk adjustment, like Apache 4 or 2?
Right.
And the second question is your ventilator-associated pneumonia rates.
Uh-huh. Right.
Who is determining the diagnosis of VAP?
Right.
On your, because, as you know, I'm sure it works the same way in HHC, and my colleagues
mm-hmm.
in NCB and Jacoby, they rotate through the ICUs. So it's a different ICU attending probably every week or, something similar to that, or every two
right.
weeks. But is it the infection control nurse or a researcher or a data collector or an individual
right.
physician who is determining this every day and making a decision as to whether VAP is there or not?
Right. That's a great question. We actually did a breakout session at our learning session in January just on the ventilator-associated pneumonia
yeah.
measure because I think, wanted to have a better understanding of what we were getting. And so we did review, and in fact, when I meet with the ICU directors this Friday, and one of the things we on the agenda is to kind of re-disseminate or communicate kind of one standard set of how we're what we're counting as ventilator associated pneumonia. But what we learned from that was in most cases the what happens is that the kind of the the first level of identification of a nosocomial pneumonia for a patient on a ventilator is done by the infectious control person. But particularly as part of this process, the physician who's been leading the team has been reviewing that to confirm that the diagnosis and the timing, I would actually put it in this in the category of a ventilator-associated pneumonia based on the CDC definition. In some of our hospitals, though, the focusing on this last year really has led to creating a data collection strategy that wasn't there before. So, and you mentioned that, the Jacoby's one example where she now has the physician who's leading the team now has created their own separate data collection sheet for ventilator-associated pneumonia, and the ICU fellow has been placed, given that responsibility, to review those patients and confirm those cases. So we definitely have been struggling with it a bit as well, which is why it's easier to talk about who's doing the bundle than without having more a longer period of time to know fully what to make of some of the infection data. What we've tried to do at the same time, though, at least so that people have some idea what they're doing, is that I don't think practices haven't changed within a hospital. So I'm more confident that however they've been counting ventilator-associated pneumonias, they've been consistently doing it. But now that we're more at a stage, we certainly want to also be able to look across all of the hospitals. And in fact, we'll start reporting this data to our quality committee of our board as well. We will be confirming that data collection strategies. On the other two, we're also similarly we haven't done a lot. Frankly, including reporting on the mortality rates just as a raw number. We have not. We frankly haven't done focused very much on the mortality data. Certainly not in terms of and not in a way that we could compare it across the hospitals, because we haven't done any. We haven't asked people to present it in a risk adjusted way that would allow for a comparison across the hospitals. But it does give them some additional outcome point to begin to look at, so they at least are getting in more of the habit of looking at their own data, which I think the experience across the corporation is that part of this whole improvement process has been to get people more attuned to and used to looking at to looking at and starting to use the data. At the ICU length of stay, we actually had a very nice presentation and discussion from Mitchell Levy from Rhode Island at the January meeting, because there's been a lot of concern about looking at the ICU, the length of stay, the entire length of stay, the time the patient might be in the unit versus when, kind of the unit feels they're ready to leave, but there's no place for them to go. And so there again, we had some hospitals who have been reporting both the overall time the patient's in the unit, but also the time that they really felt the patient needed to be in the unit. Mitchell Levy from Rhode Island said that that's what they've moved to at his hospital, and that has actually been a very useful process in terms of working with senior leadership. To be able to really identify with clear data, which part was more under the control of the ICU and which part reflected other issues in the hospital. So that was our discussion in January, and we are actually going to move to both to having hospitals look at both, try to report on both aspects of length of stay, so we can try to get some better data on that for the for us as a corporation.
Thank you.
Sure.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key. And our next question comes from Barbara Belmont from Lenox Hill Hospital.
Hello. Hi.
Hello.
Dr. Barr.
Hi. On one of these slides, it says that you're using training videos and materials. We as a group are sort of interested on what the depth of those materials are, and could other people possibly utilize those?
Yeah, you know, that's one of the ways that, the Queens Hospital Center is kind of responding to what they thought might have happened in the summer when their rates went up. So they're actually just developing those and kind of testing them out on their staff. So I'm happy to check in with them in terms of, you know, what they, where they feel they are in the process in terms of sharing them. Those are in development right now.
Thank you. And actually, Karen, on the Jenny website, we've collected at least a few examples of some training materials that our hospitals have developed. So we'll, Hillary, after the call, we'll try to help you pinpoint exactly find those.
Sure, and I'll check with Queens on theirs.
Because Lenox Hill is actually one of the places that has developed their own.
Oh, great.
Operator, do we have any more questions or comments?
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key.
Well, hearing none, Karen, thank you so much. You're welcome to stay with us if you'd like, but if you have to move on, we once again appreciate your joining us and hope we'll have you back again at an appropriate interval to give us another update. And I think at this point, we will turn over to Hillary to talk a little bit about the preliminary results of our survey of interventions.
Thanks, Rachel.
Thanks, Rachel. So we sent you a PowerPoint yesterday afternoon at around 12-ish, and I know some of you probably didn't have a chance to take a look at it. So I'm just going to go through briefly some of the key points that came out of what we've received so far as results from hospitals. So far, we actually do have a pretty good turnout from the hospitals. We got 27 total responses from hospitals. This includes North Shore Long Island Jewish Health System. They answered as a system, although a couple of the questions which we'll go through, they answered specifically for the hospitals. And basically, the point of this survey was to identify the different interventions that have been tested and implemented by the hospitals participating in the CLAPS collaborative. And we really hope to get all of your responses just so that we have a real comprehensive picture of all the results. And we're going to be actually putting together a much bigger overview of these results, including a lot of the information on the dates implemented that you gave to us. But for now, if you go on to the third slide, these are the results to the question of, have you implemented the central line bundle in the units involved in the CLABS collaborative? And of the responses, this is by hospital, there's 22 that have fully implemented the bundle and 5 that have partially implemented the bundle. There were no responses that we have not implemented the bundle. And just a little bit of detail on that, of the hospitals that have partially implemented the bundle, 2 have not fully implemented the maximal sterile barrier precautions, and 2 have not fully implemented a procedure for reviewing the line necessity, and 1 has not fully implemented preferred site of line placement at the hospital. And then the other area that we found so far is the use of the checklist. So all the components of the bundle have been implemented, although 3 hospitals are not yet using a central line checklist to monitor compliance with the bundle. They have specified target dates for that and are planning to do it, but 3 have not are not using a central line checklist.
I think, Hillary, if I could just interrupt you briefly here at this point, I noticed in looking at the latest IHI 100,000 Live campaign email update, which they send out periodically, the issue of reviewing line necessity is one a topic that they have a discussion group going on right now. So if anybody is particularly interested in that issue, if you go to the 100,000 Live campaign website, hopefully you'll find a section devoted to discussion threads, and there might be some interesting information there. I just happened to notice that earlier. I thought I'd mention it here.
Yeah, and actually I was just talking to someone earlier about the IHI's website. Their discussion threads have a wealth of information about actual implementation of the bundle. So maybe we'll also email you a link to their discussion threads. The next slide talks a little bit about the use of the daily goal sheets during interdisciplinary rounds. So out of what we found so far, there from the survey responses, 67% are using the daily goal sheets in our collaborative, and 33% are not using daily goal sheets. We did get reasons for why some hospitals aren't using the daily goal sheets. Some have said that there's not enough evidence that says that the daily goal sheets improves patient care, so there's not a lot of physician buy-in to that. I interviewed a couple of people who said this, and they said, while Peter Pronovost's work in this area is good work, it doesn't necessarily mean that this improves patient care. So that's one thing that we heard. Another thing that we heard were that hospitals are taking really other innovative approaches instead of actually using a daily goal sheet form. One hospital said that they're using dry erase boards. So they say it's really easy to update. It's at the patient's bedside, and they have less paper and less analysis of data, and all the practitioners can review the patient's progress at the bedside. So we thought that was something we should share with you that is an interesting approach. A couple hospitals actually have told us time and time again that daily goal sheets during weekend shifts is tough, so they just stopped using it for the weekend shift. I know at least one hospital in the collaborative that has done a good job on the weekend shift, so perhaps we can tell those hospitals that are having problems with that to talk to that hospital. And finally, I have a couple responses about daily goal sheet, that the data that it takes to analyze the data, it's really intensive resources, so these sheets were just getting collected and not being fed back to clinicians. Use of central line customized kits is the next slide. Out of the responses we got, again, 72% are using central line customized kits, and another 11% are going to be implementing different customized kits. And then we put together a little graph here on what has been implemented. So as you can see here, insertion and maintenance kits are mostly used, with 78% of the responses for insertion and 76% for maintenance kits. And another 6% in each category are planning on implementing these kits. The helper kits, this was something that Allison Scaduto from Greater New York Hospital Association described on one of our earlier calls. This is not something that's mandatory, but this was something as she made her visits to the hospitals, she found that some were saying it would be great to have a cap and a gown and a mask and a glove set aside in a pack for kind of a helper person who's helping in the insertion technique. So a few of you are using those at this point. 12%. And the next slide just shows the use of the central line checklist for insertion and or maintenance, and we've displayed the results here. Most of you, about 83% of the responses, are using it for insertion, and another 11% are going to start using a checklist for insertion, and 6% aren't using it at all for insertion. A lesser percent are using it for maintenance, 50% of the responses, and 6% are planning to use it. We did have a couple reasons as to why they're not being used for maintenance. Some are saying that they're actually monitoring maintenance through daily rounds, so they're not using the checklist for that because it's already being accomplished in the rounds. And then another hospital said that they conduct random audit checks to ensure appropriate line maintenance. So a little information there. The next one, and we know that some of you have been very interested in this next one, use of the antimicrobial patch or biopatch. So far, this is a hospital-wide response. So North Shore LIJ gave us their responses separately for each hospital. And we come to 37% or 10 of you are using the biopatch. And 59% of you, or 16 of you, are not using the biopatch. We had another one hospital, which represented 4% of the respondents, that will be using the biopatch eventually, but it has not been implemented yet. A little variation on the use of it, too, because we've had lots of questions about that. Everyone that's using the biopatch who responded is using it upon insertion and for maintenance. Five responded that they're using it on all central lines. A couple more of you are taking a different approach, and three are using it on lines that are in place for seven or more days. And another one hospital said that they're using it on all femoral lines only. So, there you have some data there. Again, hopefully we'll get a little bit more for you on that. Root cause analysis, which was the next slide, we wanted to know how many of you are conducting root cause analysis when a CLAB infection is identified.
Just before you get there, just to refresh everyone's memories, that the use of the biopatch is not a part of the bundle at this point. So the fact that we have a variation in the use here is a reflection of what I think is a accepted variation in practice at this point, and we are not necessarily looking for 100% or 0% on that particular measure or on, I think, the ones that follow.
Right, and I should have specified that, that's not part of the bundle.
Quite all right.
So, and as for root cause analysis, this one, there is quite a bit of variation among the hospitals in the collaborative. We didn't even get you the data yet on who identifies the infection and how quickly it identifies, because really it is all over the board. We do show that 74% of the respondents are conducting root cause analysis, and another 11% will be conducting it. Several of the hospitals have initiated and implemented procedures where root cause analysis is done very quickly, you know, immediately after a positive blood culture is brought to the infection control team's attention. And then there's other hospitals that aren't doing it quite as quickly. It's sort of where an infection control practitioner does the RCA, and then summaries are shared with practitioners involved sort of toward the end of the month. So it's a little looser. But again, we're going to be getting you more of that data. And finally, the last slide talks about spread. And I was actually surprised when I saw how much this is spreading. And we had from the responses that 67% have already started spreading, and 33% haven't yet, but they're planning to, and there were actually no responses to no on this question. So that's really positive. Seven of you said that you've spread this to other ICUs that were not originally in the CLABS collaborative. Quite a few of you, eight of you, said that you're spreading to the EDs. Five to the OR setting, four to the med-surg units, four to radiology, two to hemodialysis, and one in anesthesiology. And another one of you said hospital-wide. So, again, the entire survey will be analyzed when we get a few more responses. We're going to be giving you data on the physician and nurse competencies and educational materials to spread the initiative. That data was not analyzed yet because, again, there was a lot of variation and we wanted to get you some preliminary results. And with that, I'll open it up and see if anyone has any questions about this report. Operator?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key. If your question has been answered and wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. And we have a follow-up question from Barb Belmont.
Dr. Barr here.
Hi.
Could you, since we canceled the next March meeting, we have April 5th, I know, and then we have the all-day meeting in May. Do we have other meetings scheduled for April or May?
We will have. We haven't. We have one speaker lined up for one of our May calls, but we're just in the process of scheduling the speakers and topics for those calls.
I see. Okay, thank you.
We're just taking a breath during March, and just to explain, we did get feedback from some folks that they felt that the content, that while these calls in general have been very helpful, the content was perhaps getting a little bit repetitive, and we wanted to be responsive to that and also sort of focus in, as I said earlier, on planning for some of our future collaborative activities. But it will be a little bit premature at that next call, or what would have been the next call, to discuss those with you. So we're taking a little bit of a planning break. We're giving you all a little bit of a conference call break. Obviously, we expect you all to keep up the good work that you're already doing. But we will resume regular calls with the April 5th call and thereafter through our learning session. Sometime between now and then, we will review with you our plans for what happens after that next learning session and both the periodicity and the content and the strategy for those calls. But we just wanted to take a break for this upcoming call so that we could be doing some other work. But we appreciate your interest in continuing these conversations because you guys have been very enthusiastic participants.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key. We have a question from Robert Garcia from Brookdale Medical Center.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Just a couple of questions. On the slide that you have with the central line customized kit, I'm wondering because one of the recommendations is to use 2% chlorhexidine, and that, I don't recall in the survey that was asked separately. And, you know, I don't really, just for maybe my own ignorance here, what is the difference between a barrier kit and an insertion kit?
Well, actually, I have that right in front of me, because I knew that would be a question. the insertion kit has more, this is really more of an Allison Scaduto question than a Hillary question, but there's more of the safety-engineered injection needles in the insertion kits as the way they were configured.
So the insertion kit is the one that actually has a central line.
Exactly. And the barrier kits have the things like the cap, the mask, the gloves, the gown, the drape, the alcohol swab.
But I'm a little confused then because therefore, there are hospitals that are not buying an insertion kit. They're buying central lines and all the things you need to insert separately. I didn't even think you could be able to do that.
I don't know about that. I know a lot of times the supplies are in, we're talking about the customized pack kits and not a cart in this case.
Oh, I understand that.
Okay.
I am talking about the same thing. I'm talking about a barrier kit to me is the one that has the gowns, gloves, and mask and the drape, I assume.
Mm-hmm, right.
The insertion kit would be the one that has the actual central line, the syringes, and all that.
Right, that's right.
I wouldn't think that an insertion kit components are sold separately or somebody would be using that separately.
Yeah, we can look further into that, Bob. It's Terry.
Yeah.
And see just...
We'll go back and ask the people who did not indicate a positive response on that and find out what they have now.
Maybe they just misunderstood.
Could be.
Down the road is the intention to link up the implementation of these individual interventions with the individual outcomes of each of the facilities? In other words, to show, you know, which of these interventions is actually being actually useful, you know, or effective.
We're hoping that we could do some linkages. I'm not sure we will be able to do it so rigorously as we would have liked originally, because we have a hard time getting the exact dates of when folks made the actual implementation of each intervention.
I see. Okay.
And that's also part of why, see, with HHC, and why I wanted Karen to highlight some of their results, when they started with the combination of monitoring both the process measures and the outcome measures simultaneously. What we had elected to do was start with the outcome measures and then try to backfill, if you will, collecting the data on the process measures.
Right.
So we in effect, did not create for ourselves the easiest path to create that linkage. However, I think as Terry indicated, and Hillary indicated, as we are able to get the sophistication of our analysis of your responses a little bit more, and also as we prepare for some of the presentations for our final, or at least our first year learning session, I think we might be hoping we could include some presentations around those issues.
Yeah.
Then we'll have Dr. Shannon with us, who I expect will be able to share some information about some of the conclusions that they've drawn based on their work so far.
Great work, by the way. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. The other thing, just to add on to what Rachel said, too, that we do know and we recognize a lot of you in your monthly team reports who are measuring process. We applaud you for doing that. And we know, you know, we get those reports and we really look at those, your bundle compliance.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, quite honestly, we probably should have started with a more uniform process of collecting that data from the very beginning, but we were, it's hard to imagine this now, but at the beginning we were just so worried about the burden of all of this data collection that we were going to be doing for the infection rates that we didn't want to sink the whole ship. With, you know, additional data collection. So a little bit of a judgment that we made at the time that what we really all wanted to know at the end of the day was the outcome. But I think we will be able to, as I said, backfill some of that information and work with some of you, and particularly as we plan our future activities. I think this is one of the examples of an area that we'd like to focus on in terms of the sustaining and spreading of the improvement progress that all of you have made so far.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key. And I'm showing no further questions at this time.
Could I just ask one question? As Rachel, Hillary, and I are considering our future projects, all information is confidential, so please speak up. We're just trying to figure out what direction to go in and what was lacking or what we could do to help move a quality improvement program along a little faster. I was speaking to some folks on Tuesday on some other issues, and they tell me that the only thing that really pushes the staff in many of the units that they've done quality improvement on, and this is in another state, is having the CEO and other senior leadership actually do rounds on the units that the improvements are being made. And I was just curious in how many of your institution that actually happens routinely. Any comments? Operator, if you could open up the lines.
We have a question or comment from Dr. Barb.
Dr. Barb.
Hello. Hi. So you're asking what are the things, if we're still at a loss with some of these training materials. I know I asked about them, but if we could really have some type of physician training materials in terms of some kind of videos, I mean, that would really be very helpful.
Well, we do have Dr. Shannon's video, the initial one.
No.
And we were trying to get the insertion video from
him. Oh,
that's
what I was talking about.
Right. And I believe Bob Garcia was making one of those videos also. I don't know where he is with that.
Well, you know, if one of those insertion videos could be made available to everyone, I think that would go a long way, because if you see something visually, it's much better than sort of explaining it.
Right. And we have talked about your request. We have not forgotten it.
Okay.
You know, and also, we're in touch with Dr. Shannon again, so we'll see. The last time we spoke with him about that, he was having some sort of editing issues with it, but we'll see where he is with it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions or comments, please press the 1 key. We have a question or comment from Albert Pan from Forest Hills Hospital.
Thank you.
Yes, good afternoon. It's a very good telecast. The question, well, actually, was a comment. Somebody asked about having the hospital supervisors or administration making rounds. At Forest Hills, our chief of medical officer makes rounds, goes through the charts, looks at the particulars, gets the reports, and this way he's quite visible to MDs or residents and staff that it is an important issue.
Do you think it helps your process move forward a little more rapidly?
That I really can't say yes or no, but I know I'm the infection control nurse here, and it gives me more credence because they're seeing from the top. So when I have to intercede a few times, that they realize that there's weight.
Thank you.
We have a question or comment from Mary Matigue from Trinitas Hospital.
Hi. Our group just wanted to respond to your comment, Terry, that's your question, in terms of that, you know, we really feel it's really the physician champion that is the more important person. I mean, certainly it's nice to get rah-rahs from the CEO in terms of, you know, how well you're doing, but it's really the physician champion and his or her drive to make things happen along with the other clinical leaders in the area, as well as the fact that, you know, your physician champion and clinical leaders have to be respected in the organization so that, you know, attending physicians will buy into it as well. You know, our ICU is open, and despite that fact, we've still been able to be really successful. So I think it's more physician and clinical leadership necessarily than senior administration.
Thanks, Mary.
We have a question or comment from Robert Garcia from Brookdale Medical Center.
Hi. I just wanted to comment about that that video.
Yep.
We had produced a video in-house a while ago, I did want Greater New York and UHF to look at this video when they do their on-site visit to us, just you know, for their comment before I would we would share it with anybody else. Okay, so just you know, we're willing to, but we just want to make sure that everything is okay. You know,
we appreciate that, Bob.
Okay.
Thanks, Bob.
Sure.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or comment at this time, please press the 1 key.
I think this has been a really good discussion, Hillary, you can just quickly update us again on our schedule issues, and we'll close.
Okay. The next conference call, it's on April 5th, so just like what Rachel said before, the March 15th call will be canceled. So April 5th, which is also a Wednesday, we're going to be revisiting the discussion on return on investment for infections in general. I know on the agenda I wrote CLAB infections, but Dr. Shannon will be back with us, and he's going to talk about the return on investment and also spreading efforts out beyond the ICU setting a little bit more. And we just got confirmation about a May 10th conference call. So I just want to, if you could hold that date, that would be great. We're going to be switching gears just a tiny bit on that call. And the University of Rochester will join us. to talk about their efforts in ventilator-associated pneumonia. And I know a lot of you have overwhelmingly expressed interest in this topic, so we wanted to dedicate a call to that. And one thing about University of Rochester's Strong Memorial is that they have not had a VAP in over a year at this point. So they're very, rightfully so, proud of their work.
They have had a couple of Legionella cases recently.
Sorry.
It isn't one thing, it's another, you know.
Follow, Rachel.
And then lastly, we keep writing it just because we want to keep reinforcing it. The Learning Session 3 all-day session will be Wednesday, May 24th, and Terry, Rachel, and I will be giving you more information about that very soon. So that being said,
And I'd just like to mention to folks in our conversation with Dr. Shannon when we got him on board to participate in the April 5th call, and we just kind of briefly reviewed with him some of the results that we've achieved so far. And I just wanted to share with everybody, and I know Terry would share this as well, just the extraordinary enthusiasm and pride that he expressed in terms of the results that we have achieved through this collaborative. And it obviously is reflected in his commitment to continue to take his extremely precious time and continue to spend it with us. But I just want to let folks know that he was quite emphatic in sharing with us, just how excited he is at the results that we've been able to achieve so far, and how much he has shared with other people around the country who constantly call him, the good work that we've been doing. So the word is spreading out there. It may not be, on the front page of our newspapers every day, but I do want to let you know that at least I think, continue to have a real champion for our efforts with Dr. Shannon. And we're extremely pleased that he will be able to join us for that call and his commitment to help us in future activities as well. But I did want to share that with you because it was just a nice, a good a positive note for us in terms of his reaction to some of the preliminary data that we were able to share with him a few weeks ago. Terry, did you have anything else that you wanted to add or cover?
No, I just echo your statements about Dr. Shannon, and he really is speaking highly of what's going on in New York at every meeting he goes to, whether it's on a local or national level, and even down in Washington. So we really applaud all of your efforts, and we can hope to continue to work very closely with all of you as we move forward on new initiatives. So thank you for your time.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, everyone. We'll see you or talk to you on April 5th.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect. Have a great day.